Hello. Yes.
Is there any way the midterm can't be on Halloween? At all?
You think it's more of a trick than a treat? Is that what you're telling me? It's a special day.
It is a special day. I grant that. I wasn't sure how this would interfere with it, but
another possibility is the midterm could be the 29th, and then the review session would be the previous week. Thought it'd be nice to put them close together. Is that preferable to getting Halloween stepped on?
No.
You can come to the test with, you know, a costume. That'd be awesome. I'll put extra pen on for that. The other idea would be to push it to the next week, which is where it had been. And I think we're just starting to drag it out at that point. Just kind of bang, bang, get it done. What's your two bits?
How much extra credit?
For the costumes?
You know,
some amount. I don't know. I need to see what. I probably will do 10 questions, 10 points each. So it could be, you know, 3.
But, you know, it has to be. So my son is now the age, he's 13, he's now the age where he's realized that one could go out trick-or-treating without a costume if one has a good cover story. Like, I'm dressed as a middle school boy. Like, no, that's not okay. Yes, it's true, but it's not really a costume. I'm dressed as the spirit of Christmas past posing as a middle school boy. No, it's not okay. That's just cheating. So, at the moment it doesn't feel like there's a groundswell of support for the Let's Avoid Halloween because it's special. I can try to make the questions as Halloween spirited as, you know, as I can. It'll be fun. It'll be fun for me. I don't know how you guys will feel about it. I don't see a way around it, unfortunately. All right, so is that all I needed to say about that? Is everything else up and running?
This is happening.
All right. So, yeah. Any questions or comments on other issues? People who, yeah.
Okay. Did you know, you sent out said open notebook? Question mark.
Yes.
Question mark.
As in, like, what we wrote in our notebooks or what we printed out.
You can bring anything you want. The book, other books, take photographs of kind friends. What you can't do is have any kind of communication device. So like a cell phone that you could like ask people questions of, or some kind of internet, you know, chatty thing, which is sort of not okay, earpiece, I'm not okay with that. It's mostly, you know, as long as it's you and your stuff, I don't care what you got. I heard somebody under his or her breath last semester say, well, the communication device wouldn't help because nobody that I know knows any of this stuff. Like, okay, well, good. I mean, I'm just saying. That's the only thing that would bother me. Anything else you could bring with you. I've seen people bring big stacks of stuff. In fact, all the questions, and I will try to be more precise about this, but all the questions are going to be variants of questions from homeworks. And all the homework questions, all the relevant homework questions have also all been asked as clicker questions, at least, you know, in form, you know, like add these binary numbers, this, what does this loop do, that kind of stuff. It's all stuff that you've seen. So once you know what those questions are, you really only need to bring the stuff that's relevant to those questions. So I will, and I'll give you more feedback about precisely. And what I like to do is actually make a sample midterm. Say, here are the 10 questions. I'm going to do these exact same 10 questions, except all the details will be different. Right. If I'm going to ask you to add two binary numbers, I'm not going to tell you which two binary numbers on the practice midterm. Because, you know, at that point, it doesn't really seem like you're thinking. All right? Yeah, go ahead. The other week.
Yeah.
I can think about it. Though again, I think there are some advantages, obviously, moving it back, but there are also disadvantages, and at the moment it's feeling like the disadvantages are bigger. But you know, again, the more data I have, the more accurately I can assess the advantages and disadvantages.
Can you do a quicker question on it?
On the exam?
No, a quicker question for when the exam.
Yeah.
All right, pose it for me. What are you suggesting?
A is 29, B is the other day, or 31.
There's 29, 31, and then there's the original day, which is like the 7? Is that right?
Yeah.
7? So...
that is 31.
You guys, you all know what the term non-binding resolution means, right? Okay, just needed to make sure. So, 10:29 is the Monday of the week of Halloween. 10:31 is the Wednesday of, that is actually Halloween. What's the spookiest day of the week to have Halloween? Is it Wednesday?
No, it's Friday.
Friday would be better. I agree with that. All right. 11:07 is the date that it was on the calendar, but it could also be that Monday, which I guess is 11:05. And I'm writing all this in pink, which is a bad idea. E should be all of the above, just to keep you from actually choosing that.
I did none of the above. I would get no valuable information. So, as requested, we're now doing a quicker vote. Oh, you really can't see it. Can you see it? Sorry for using paint.
All right, I'm voting Halloween. I pointed it at the chalkboard because obviously the chalkboard was this one. All right. All right. Anybody else need to click in? 5, 4, 3, 2. I mean, you could choose E for don't care. If you really don't want to weigh in, tilt things any particular direction. The E's are going up now. All right. And remember, non-binding resolution, but it is interesting data. Here's the data. That's the Halloween date. So we're getting, most people are seeing it sort of the way I was seeing it, which is, yeah, it's not ideal to do it then, but that way we get to have the review right before it. We'll have it on a Wednesday. It'll be done. Are things changing? Very funny. All right. So again, that doesn't mean that if I see a good reason to switch it, I may, I reserve the right to do that. But at the moment, yeah, I'm still kind of liking this. Okay. All right. That being said, presumably that's it on administrative stuff at the moment. There's a bunch of stuff to get to, so I think I'd like to get in there. All right. So I say reduction a lot, because I think people know what I mean, but I don't know that you know what I mean. So the purpose of this question is just to make sure that we're all on the same page. And if not, it's okay, we can fix that. I'll just be more explicit. But, But there was a big reduction punch. Whoa, look at those numbers go up. All right, there was a big reduction punchline at the end of last week, and the punchline tends to be muted if you actually don't know what I mean. Put as an extra credit, I think it was an extra credit, on the final last semester. If you had to define computer science in one word, what would it be? And mostly people put variations of reduction. Though sometimes it was like reductification. I mean, people were making up words that sounded like reduction but weren't quite reduction. And then two people put my name as the answer, which, by the way, is two words, not one. And both of them spell my name wrong. So, if you're going to try to kiss up, I don't think you should try to kiss up, but if you're going to kiss up, at least spell my name right. All right. 5 seconds. 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. Okay, one more clicker question, so get that clicker out. Oh, excellent. Yes, all right, so Eve. It's about taking complicated problems and changing their form in some way that the solution to the simpler problem actually solves the more complicated problem. All these other things are good goals, and computer scientists do actually care about these things, making machines, reducing the amount of time it takes to make the next generation machine, reducing
how reducing cycle time, in other words, how fast each processing cycle takes, would make the computers faster. There, people are very excited about that. Reducing the size of the circuitry so you can have more computer power and less space, which also, by the way, tends to bring the cycle time up. Do you know why? Why are smaller computers faster?
Less distance
of what? From your brain to the, no, to the body, not quite. It is about the distance. But what's traveling? What's traversing the distance?
Isn't it like electrons?
The electrons on the wires. That these computers are so fast now that the time that it takes information to travel, electricity to travel from one point to another on the wire, actually is the limiting factor in how fast some of these computer components can work. That these engineers are now working at the level of the speed. It's the speed of light. It's how fast waves propagate. Which is really hard for me to imagine. What's that?
Have they reached the limit yet? Or not?
So I've heard stories that it's not quite at the limit, but in the next 20 years, there's no way that they can make computers faster because they can shrink them. Once they shrink them enough, you start to worry about quantum mechanical effects. That basically, when something's tiny enough, it isn't really there anymore. It's sort of there and not there. The cat is dead. The cat is not dead. Anyway, it's sort of all your notions of determinism, like the world that we see and how things work, go away when you're at this tiny, tiny nanoscale. And so once the computer chips are that small, there's no way they can make them faster by just making them smaller. The computers stop being functional at that point.
They would just have to optimize the structure?
They can optimize the structure, and they can take different ways of actually, different designs of the computer. So instead of one processor that's doing all the work, maybe you have a bunch of slow processors. Like people's brains are pretty fast. Each neuron is actually much, much slower than a computer. But we've got a whole bunch of them, and they work together really well. And so maybe we need computers that are more like that. All right, last quicker question. This is getting at, last time we talked about subroutines. And so here's a little example with subroutine to make sure that you really understand how these things work. So when we click the green flag, the top script runs, but it also can call the bottom script, A. And the question is, you start the thing going, when all is said and done, it will pop some number of times. How many times will it do that? Majority was right, but there was a lot of disagreement. There were a lot of people thinking about it other ways. So let me talk this through and make sure that it makes sense to you, and we'll see what happens from there. All right, so I think the first thing to do to try to understand something like this is first, there's two scripts. There's the main script that starts when the flag is clicked, and then there's this subroutine, this second script. Let's first figure out what the second script does. Then, once we have that in our heads, now we can use this reduction idea to say, well, we don't have to look at that again. We know what it does. Whenever it gets called, we know what it's going to do. So what does this script do? What does A do? When it receives A, how many times does it pop? Two? Peace. Nice. All right. So whenever A gets called, there'll be two pops. Okay? So now we don't have to care about the details of A anymore. Maybe there was all this other junk in there, it was doing other things other than popping, but really, when all is said and done, it pops twice. So now let's go to the main routine. What does this do? First thing it does is it pops. The second thing it does is it calls A, which pops twice. Then it calls A again. So it pops twice again, and then it stops. So it pops once on its own, and then it calls A to get another two. Then it calls A to get another two. And then that's all the pops that it does before it stops. Okay? So there'd be E, which is five pops. But a couple people weighed in at the three and four level. The reason I thought some people might say three is if you just look at it, if you don't think through what the steps are, you just look at it,
there's three pops, right? There's one up there and there's two down there. That's three. But the thing you have to realize, right, is that these two live inside a subroutine that gets called twice. So again, if you think about it like a song, and I don't know why you would, but if you were to think about it like a song, if this is the chorus and you say the word, you pop twice in the chorus, and then in the main song you sing the chorus twice, then there's going to be two pops for each of those choruses, for a total of four from the choruses and then one from the main verse. Right? And I don't think you'd be at all fooled if I wrote this as a song, if I said chorus, and then said, you know, how many times is the word, waterfall said in this song? If it's in the chorus twice, and in one of the verses it's in there once, and there's two choruses, you would figure out that it was five. It's the same thing as that. So don't be fooled by the notation, unless you can't actually read the notation, in which case you should probably ask me to clarify. But is this, are we clear, you think? Better? Okay. I'm going to ask, I like this question now. This is a new kind of question that I made up for today, and I like it. So I'm going to probably come up with variations of this, with maybe multiple subroutines, maybe some variables. Party for everybody. All right. Good. All right, so that's it for the clicker questions. The other thing that we're going to do today, all right, so this is now, I'm going to wrap up chapter 3 and then go into chapter 4. A lot of the stuff in chapter 4, at least the stuff that I find really fun in chapter 4, is about self-reference and self-contradiction. So things that refer to themselves. It gets really twisted and fun when you do that. So it turns out that recursion, which we're talking about in chapter 3, has elements of this that are worth talking about. So we built a little song for Old MacDonald. Oh, would it help anybody to see? Never mind. We could have done that little scratch program really fast just to see that it goes pop, 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 pop. Yeah. It does five pops, so you can count them. If that makes it more real to you, then we could do that. But not clear how that helps. It's worth the time. Anyway, so we talked about the Old MacDonald song and scratch, and in the Old MacDonald song, some of the routines, some of the scripts were calling other scripts to get some of their work done. And then when the other scripts were done, it went back to the main script and continued on like that. And so this idea of one subroutine calling another subroutine turns out to be really useful and powerful. You can also have subroutines, not so much in Scratch, or in a limited way in Scratch, but in more powerful languages, you can have subroutines that call themselves in all kinds of crazy ways. And that's called recursion. When you have a subroutine that refers to itself. And in fact, it's also called recursion in other settings. And I'm going to show you some of those other settings in a little bit. Shapes that have the itself as part of a subshape of itself. I'll show you examples of that. And in language, you can have phrases that have the same kind of phrase embedded inside of them. And all these things are variants of recursion. So what I'd like to do is just to kind of get your head around it, I'm going to give some examples. Yeah? Was that a question?
How did it not become stuck in itself?
Yes.
And not allow anything else to control.
Right. So there's a really important thing, and we looked at this last time. There were two variations that came up. This is an example of recursion that's okay. And what happens is here, sing the 99 bottles of beer on the wall song, but it actually sings it from whatever the current value of the variable bottles is. And the reason that this is okay, so to sing the song, it says a bunch of words, and then it goes and it calls itself. It actually refers back to itself. And why doesn't this cause it to just keep, you know, lather, rinse, repeat, lather, rinse, repeat, just get stuck in this loop and never get out? And the answer is, look at the very first thing there. It's a big if statement. And the if statement says, we're only going to do any of this stuff if we've got bottles. If we have no bottles of beer, if there's zero or fewer bottles of beer, this does nothing. And that little test at the top is called the termination condition. It says, you can call yourself all you want, but there has to be a time to stop. That's the termination condition. And with the termination condition, this kind of recursion is okay, because it'll run up until the termination condition is reached, and then it'll stop, and then the life can continue. Without the termination condition, if it calls itself, it could get stuck in this situation where it just keeps calling itself over and over and over again, and it never unravels. Does that help? Answer the question? Yeah, so you have to have this termination condition. That's sort of the one critical piece of recursion that makes the whole thing fly. Yeah?
So wait, the same thing as a base case?
With analogy to inductive proofs in mathematics, sometimes it's called a base case. Yeah, you can think of it, they're synonyms.
sometimes I use the word base case. So when I was poking around online over the weekend, a lot of people call them termination conditions, so I adopted that. It seems more program-related to say it that way. All right, so this is an OK song, and I think I have, yeah, so I have one that was a non-OK song, not-OK example of recursion, where when it's trying to sing the song, it sings a line of the song, and then it goes back and sings, then starts the song over again. And so the song ends up never ending because it's always, at, you know, it sings one line and then it starts again from scratch. So it sings one line and then it starts again from scratch. So this never unravels. It does not have a termination condition or base case, and so it doesn't stop. But so this kind of recursion seems like sort of a cute trick. But one of the things that's interesting is people's brains. There's reason to think that people's brains, because of the way they deal with language, because of the way we all deal with language, the recursion is actually a very deep and fundamental part of us. And we may not spend a lot of time thinking about it, but it does naturally come up in all sorts of settings. And so when you play with these Russian nesting dolls, which somebody said they're called mamushka dolls, I don't know if anybody knows the right name for them, but you play with these, right? So you have the big mommy doll, and you open it up, you take it out, and there's another smaller mommy doll inside of it. And if you open that one up, there's another one inside of it. You play this recursion game, eventually you get down to the termination condition, or the base case, which is a tiny little solid wood doll that you get at the very end that doesn't have anything inside it. Otherwise, we could continue to just keep playing this game indefinitely. Presumably those kind of toys are hard to make. And then I also, once upon a time, I didn't eat a lot of green vegetables, and my spouse, though at that time my girlfriend, told me, you know what, you should like broccoli. It's a fractal. It has self-similar structure, which was all it took for me to actually try it, and it turned out not to be so bad. So recursion helped me, you know, become a more healthy person. But if you look, so this is a little chunk of broccoli. If you look at the whole chunk of broccoli, it's made up of these offshoots. But just focus on one of these offshoots, it looks like a chunk of broccoli. And in fact, if you focus on just the offshoot, there's an offshoot on that offshoot that itself looks like a little chunk of broccoli. And the screen here doesn't have enough resolution to get you down there. Eventually it does stop. You get these little, just a blip, and the blip doesn't have any mini broccolis on it. But it does go for a number of levels, right? Here it's going like four levels down. And this is another kind of example of recursion, that what a broccoli is can be defined in terms of what a broccoli is, just on a smaller scale. Since I did all the Beatles songs, there's Beatles nesting dolls. All right. I'm just saying. I like the show, but the song can get really annoying. All right, so if I do this right, I should be able to actually... So over the weekend, I finished a movie about recursion, which I would like to, this will be the world premiere, so be kind. One's ego can only take so much. So it should be under. All right. All right. All right, so this might take me 2 tries, but I'm going to give it a shot. Is everybody ready? Can we see the screen well enough? We'll go into movie mode. Enhance the experience for everyone. And I'll go back and explain the stuff that goes too fast in a little bit. I think I can make this tiny bit bigger. But how? Oh, I see. Alright, that may be as big as I can get on the screen. I'm a pecan in a paint program. I feel with the shade of your choice. I got bad code. Sometimes I miss spots. It's a sad load, and it's breaking my heart. Then
good girl. Crazy about Python, check me out. And she cleaned up my code. I was shocked when I saw how she did it. I'm just 6 lines, and I talk to myself.
Slow this down. I wrote my own paint cam program so that I could actually get inside and slow it down so you could watch what it's actually doing. And the ones that you do on a computer, there's two possibilities. First of all, they run a lot faster than this. But second of all, they don't show you the intermediate results. They'll just wait until the whole thing's filled in, then they'll display it on the screen. And so you don't see all the sort of partial results.
But back in the day, when computers were slower, and people didn't realize how annoying it was to watch it do this, this is what you see. It's actually tracing out, it's finding the edges, and filling them in. And this is how it does it. It does it not actually recursively, and the song is supposed to take you through why it ultimately isn't recursive, but the recursive way of looking at it is really very elegant. So this is the first filling program that I wrote, and this is actually busted, because what it's doing is it starts out at a certain point, and then just kind of looks above it, and looks below it, and looks to the right, and looks to the left, but it doesn't follow all the contours of the shape and fill them all in. And so that's why you get this, so it worked okay on the circle, right? Because I started it off in the middle, and it kind of stretched out from around it. But then when I gave it a funny shape like a heart, it missed three spots here. It didn't find the tippy top of the left lobe, it didn't find the right lobe at all, and then eventually it hit the bottom and didn't realize there was this extra little point there. So this is a bad film program. The thing that's cute here is, here's a better film program that actually, you know, eventually finds all the regions, and the program itself is even simpler than the one that I started with. And this is the recursive version that I stepped through in the part where I stepped through it. And this is almost identical to the code that's actually running that produced this. I think it was a little, well, first of all, I don't think I literally used white and blue, but really, it really looks like this. So this is a functional piece of code that actually does the big, complicated space-filling shit. So, all right, and it's a recursive version, and I show it, and it talks to itself, meaning it's recursive, right? We haven't been doing Python, I'm sorry. The way to read this is, it's def here doesn't mean, you know, def, it means define. We're defining a routine called flood fill recursive, and in the definition of the routine, you see it actually calls flood fill recursive. So it's saying, oh, I don't know, how do you do this? It actually calls itself recursively. But if you notice at the top, it does have a termination condition, so things end up being okay. All right, so, yeah, so it actually filled this very weird shaped region. It filled this. This was supposed to be a joke because recursion is about, you know, things acting on themselves, and this is a paint can painting a paint can. This is just, you know, remember the octopus? All right, and this is what happens here. You run the recursive algorithm on this shape, and it's so big that it actually eventually just blows up. It actually runs out of space to keep track of what it hasn't painted yet. And so, in fact, I run my algorithm list, and it really just crashed. And this is the error message that Python gives. There's a whole lot of junk here, but ultimately, the reason that it died is it says maximum recursion depth exceeded. So it can only remember so deep into the recursion stack before it just throws up its hands and says, I can't keep track of all this. I can't work under these conditions. And it just barks out, just dies. All right, so then, you know, flag is written here. Fresh R, you know, fresh. This is supposed to be also kind of a recursive joke. This is a heart that's filled with hearts, The second little hearts are kind of hard to see as hearts. They're mostly just smiles. But there's a famous shape called the Sarpinsky's gasket, which is a fractal shape. They're triangles, and each triangle has the tips filled in with this pattern repeated inside it. So the triangles filled with triangles that themselves are filled with triangles filled with triangles.
Can you Google it?
Google it? Yeah, when you want to see what it actually looks like. Remind me in a minute. It's just hard to flip back and forth. All right, so then I try to explain how this thing actually works. And you see what it's doing is it's starting from the point and then reaching out around it to see if there's any other empty space that it needs to fill. And each of those have to reach out around those. And so it kind of spreads like a, you know, disease or like water or whatever. It's always going from neighboring cells to other neighboring cells. And that tiny little recursive routine with just six lines does all that work. All right. So, but then it turned out that because of the Stack Overflow, that was a problem. So we have a different version, and this version actually was able to fill that big shape. And here's the new version. So it turns out anything you can do with recursion, you can also do by making a to-do list. And what the recursion is really doing is it's saying, hey, you know, I need to go and do this subtask. But when I'm done that, I need to come back and do whatever it was I was doing before. And to keep track of all that, essentially what this kind of algorithm does is it just writes a list of all the places it needs to check. And every time it discovers a new white square, it adds it to its list.
And every time it's done whatever it's doing, it goes back to the list and says, okay, have I checked this one yet? Oh, good, I can discard that. Okay, I turn this one blue and look around it. Anyway, that's what this does. It just keeps looping around, adding things to a to-do list, to a stack.
What's nice about that is the stack takes up a whole lot less space than all these recursive calls do. So you can actually solve much larger problems this way. But the you can see the code is more complicated. It's much harder to see what's going on when you do it this way. All right. Then I filled up the badly drawn US map. I couldn't write recursive in cursive with the little mouse, so that's I call my spouse to do that. It's better handwriting than me. Not good handwriting, she's a doctor. She's got horrible handwriting, but better than me. So okay, so then now we've got a recursive teddy bear, which is at once cute and extremely disturbing. So I tell people I can see we're reacting to it. But it is really sort of freakish. So it's a shape, it's a teddy bear shape, it's a teddy bear head. They consist of a teddy bear head, but instead of ears, it has recursively defined teddy bear heads that are smaller, stuck in where the ears go. And each of those teddy bears, continuing this recursion, they don't have ears either. They have smaller teddy bear heads as their ears. But those teddy bear heads also don't have ears. They have smaller teddy bear heads. And so that's what it looks like at the beginning, but as it actually moves through this, what this little video does, it actually zooms in on. I didn't build this, I just found this by accident. But when I found it, it was just too disturbing not to include it.
Might seem sort of weird.
So see, we're zooming in on the right ear each time, and each time we do that, there's another teddy bear there. It's not so cuddly anymore. It's sort of freakish. All right, so this is a sentence, which is somewhat self-referential because it's talking about the song itself. But what's the reason that I wanted to mention this in the context of recursion is English, and in fact, all human languages allow for various kinds of recursion inside them. That's what lets the languages be so powerful. So this is a perfectly reasonable sentence. I think nobody has any trouble understanding that sentence. But really what it is it's a sentence that has other sentences inside of it. So if you look at the bottom, it has a point. That's a sentence, right? Oh, it has a point. I've never seen that kind of pencil before. Oh, it has a point. Whatever. You can use that as a sentence. But that's actually just a subpiece of a bigger sentence. I'm beginning to wonder whether it has a point. That's a sentence, but inside that sentence there's nouns, there's verbs, and then there's a whole other sentence sitting in there. So sentences can have sentences inside them, just like the paint cans can call other paint cans, and the bears can have smaller bears. And then I did it one more level, I said, this song is so long that, and then I stuck in a sentence there. And English grammar allows you to stick sentences inside of sentences, and you can keep going down and down and down. The termination condition in English is eventually it's got to be words. Right? I can't just keep saying, this sentence is so long that, this sentence is so long that, this sentence is so long that. Eventually it has to end, otherwise your head will hurt. Alright, so that's a recursion example in language. These are pictures of vegetables that I saw, plants, that I found on the web. Has anybody seen these Romanescu broccolis before? I've never seen one. But they're almost as upsetting to look at as the teddy bears. They've got, it's this weird kind of pine cone shape made up of little blips on it. And each of those blips, it might be a little hard to see in this picture, but each of those blips is itself one of these pine cone shapes made up of little blips, which itself is one of these little pine cone shapes. I wouldn't put that anywhere near my mouth. Ferns have this nice property that a fern leaf is actually made up of smaller leaves, which look like, almost complete fern leaves. Oops. So to the, this kind of recursion shows up in nature quite often. So I just try to highlight it, that the big fern is made up of a smaller fern, and each of those leaves is itself looks like a smaller fern. I guess I shouldn't spend a lot of time on this, but there's the Fibonacci numbers. If people have played around with the Fibonacci sequence before, there's a very nice recursive definition of that that says that the nth Fibonacci number is the sum of the n-1 and n-2 Fibonacci numbers. And it all finally grounds out. The base case in this case is when n is 1 or 2, the Fibonacci number is 1. Factorial is another thing. You use factorials to figure out how many different combinations or permutations that you can get of a bunch of objects. So this is, here's three colors, and I've got them in six different permutations. The factorial function can also be defined recursively. N factorial is actually n times n minus 1 factorial. And if you haven't seen Mandelbrot sets before, they're really wacky shapes that are infinitely complicated and have in them copies of the Mandelbrot set. So the Mandelbrot set itself is made up of smaller Mandelbrot sets. These are some algorithms. We're going to talk more about a couple of these later, but we've got a sorting algorithm that sorts elements by breaking them into pieces and then sorting those pieces and then combining the results. Finding the greatest common divisor of two numbers, you can do that recursively. There's a very, very short routine that does that. Raising a number to some power, you can do that very fast using a recursive algorithm. Searching for a number in a sorted list, you can also do that recursively by saying, all right, you want to find the number in the list, check the middle number. If the number you're looking for is smaller than that number, then recursively find the number in the first half. Otherwise, recursively find it in the second half. And the size of the list keeps getting smaller and smaller as you do that. So it ends up being a very elegant way of specifying that sort of thing. I don't know, I found this, the Mona Lisa holding a picture of the Mona Lisa, which is holding a picture of the Mona Lisa. I wanted to find one of the, you ever play with a video camera, and you pointed at you and a screen on which it's showing you, and you get this sort of infinite regress of smaller and smaller views? I was looking for one of those, but I didn't find it. It's sort of here. Here's four more examples. Does anybody know that thing up in the upper left there?
Oh. American Girl Boy?
It's like American Girl, but there's another version of it. This is called My Twin, where you actually, when you buy the doll, you have to say what you look like. And they send you the doll with an outfit and then the outfit that you would wear as well. So it's like, there's you and then you've got a doll. And I was hoping that I'd find examples where people got that doll, a doll that looked just like it, and you could just keep going down like that. Of course, there's the nesting dolls again. This is the Towers of Hanoi. People know that puzzle? You know the puzzle? So you move disks from one peg to another, but you only have to move one disk at a time, and you can never put a bigger disk on top of a smaller disk. And you're trying to move the whole pile from one peg to the rightward peg, say. And it turns out that a really nice way of visualizing the solution here is what you want to do to move these six disks. The first thing you want to do in your head is think about, actually, I want to move all six of them to the right. Let's first figure out how do I solve the problem of moving the first five of them to the left. If I can do that, if I can solve that problem of moving the five disks to the left, then I can take the sixth one, move it to its final position, and then move these five to the final position. So moving six disks, you can think of as, well, I can solve that if I can just figure out how to move five. Well, of course, to move five, all you have to do is figure out how to move four. And so on, all till you're to the case of, well, now I only need to move one. How do I move one disk from one position to another? I just pick it up and move it. So it has a very nice, simple, recursive specification that lets you solve arbitrarily complicated versions of this puzzle. Does anybody know what the... presumably people have heard this story, the Cat in the Hat comes back. Do you know the little recursive part of this? Anybody think of what that might be? Do you remember the story?
As the alphabet goes on, it gets smaller and smaller.
So it's not the alphabet is related to it, but what is it? What's the alphabet being applied to?
The, I forgot exactly what it was, people, right?
Not people, but cats.
Okay.
So the cat, and it turns out, why does he have this big hat? Well, it turns out that you take the hat off, and inside, there's another cat. smaller version of the cat named Little Cat A, who also has a hat, by the way. So you take that little cat and you say, hey, I need your help with something. Oh, I can't help you, but, and he takes off his hat, and there's a smaller cat inside, Little Cat B. Anyway, it goes all the way to Z, A through Z, and then finally Z takes the hat off. You're like, whoa, what's going to be now? It turns out there's some kind of magic cleaning fluid. But anyway, up to that point, it actually seems really interesting in recursive. So family trees are recursive in the sense that a family tree, how do you make a family tree? A family tree is a man and a woman have offspring, and the offspring, each of them is the root of a family tree. A family tree is best described as multiple family trees linked by a couple that reproduce. And in fact, the tree of life, they call it, basically the way species are related to each other also has the same kind of structure. As soon as you have something that can actually make a copy of itself, now you're talking about a kind of self-reference, a kind of self-similarity. And in fact, it's really hard to write a program to deal with family trees if you don't think about it recursively. I don't know who these people are, but they're... Oh, I don't know, I think I like this more than other people do, but... I played around with Google Earth, and I found there's this pond. And this pond is surrounded by land. It's actually on an island in Lake Hatcom. I don't know if people have been...
And now it's on again. That's going to be really
annoying to put the podcast up in two halves like that. I wonder if it's running out of batteries. Anyways, right now it's saving. So as soon as it's done saving, I'll go get the Google thing.
It'll be happy if I just put the battery nearby. Thing because it's so wacky and mind-bending and does all sorts of weird, powerful things. So I guess you're accepting that, and we'll move on. So chapter 4 is called How Universal Recurring Machines, and it's actually a fairly philosophical chapter. Now, what can we say about philosophy? There may be some people here who are philosophers, and if so, I'm sorry. But I have a lot of trouble with philosophy. Just in the sense that I have trouble with it. Not in the sense that I think that there's something wrong with it or it's bad. Just that I personally, if I find it very difficult. And unfortunately, I'm in a field where it matters. There's plenty of fields like civil engineering or physical chemistry where you can just do your stuff and not worry about philosophers looking over your shoulder, but computer science is not like that. So they ask us all kinds of questions, especially the area that I'm in within computer science is artificial intelligence, and now we're treading on some very dangerous ground, right? Because we're playing with the idea of, well, what would it mean for us to make a machine intelligent? And then the philosophers get all up in arms like, you don't even know what intelligence means! Like, okay, but I know how to make programs, and I'm going to just make them intelligent. So, but they want to, you know, philosophers, they really worry about what words mean. So they want to know things like, well, does your program actually know this? What does it mean to know something? So they what is intelligence? You know, what is computation? What does it mean to compute things? If you look at like the orbit of Mars, it follows this incredibly intricate and accurate mathematical pattern. Is Mars computing something? Is it computing its own orbit? Does that make sense? Does that mean anything? When you throw a ball and it makes this nice parabola, is the ball computing a parabola?
No.
I would say no, but philosophers won't let me get away with that. So this is why I try to not hang around with
them. You threw the ball, so you did?
Yeah, but the ball, I didn't make the ball follow the parabola.
You said gravity made it follow.
Some combination of gravity and the ball and physics and, but then ultimately you can actually get valuable information about parabolas by watching the ball. So it's actually acting as a kind of calculator.
What does that mean?
So anyway, so philosophers worry about this kind of stuff, and I don't want us to worry about this stuff. But I want to at least point out that this is something that happens quite a bit. One of the reasons that people get very, very up in arms about things like computability, computers, and intelligence is, at least this is what Hillis said. This is in the chapter, which I encourage you to read. Because he does write amusingly. So Hillis now puts computer science in this line of great humiliations that was recognized by Freud. So Freud says that poor people, this is, you know, the reason we're so depressed and we need psychoanalysis is because we just keep getting knocked off of one pedestal after another. So Galileo said, yeah, well, up to this time, the world was the center of everything. And Galileo said, actually, our world is just a world among many worlds. There's nothing central or special about it. To us, of course, it's special because we're here. But, you know, but there's no a priori reason of saying that there's something spectacular about our planet. Then Darwin came along and said, actually, you know, even humanity itself is just one species among many species. They're all related and they all have their own properties. So Freud, he added himself to the list because, among other things, he thought he was great. He had a lot of interesting ideas, and that was one of them, that he was one of the great minds of all time. And he said, yes, I am adding to this list. Consciousness is just another mental process. What you think of as you is just part of a big swirling mass of ideas that are going around in your head. And the subconscious or the unconscious is just as important. And these just keep making people more and more feeling like they're not the center of the universe. So Hillis says that we can add Turing to this. So Turing, Alan Turing, was a computer scientist before there was computers. And He basically made the claim that our mind is just another computing device. So, just among many. So there's not even anything special about mind. It all just is yet another thing. And so as soon as you get into this kind of zone, now philosophers are really going to get pissed off, and they're going to start to fight you. So, or agree with you, vehemently. So that's one of the sort of philosophical aspects here. And one of the questions that then philosophers need to ask is, well, if a philosopher is going to get up and say, no, that's not okay. It's not that there's minds and they're computers and they're all just computing devices. We can just treat them the same. Minds are different. Minds are special. There are things that minds can do that computers can't do. So a philosopher will now have to make, to prove to us that there are things that minds can do that computers can't do. And so the only way that you can answer that question is if you have a very good idea of what computers can and cannot do. And so there's a whole lot of research that has gone into, let's figure out what it means to compute something and what is actually computable and what is not. So that's what I'd like to kind of teach you a little bit about. And so some of the philosophers, these are all philosophers, Dennett, Dreyfus, and Lucas, as they said, here's something, I got one, here's something that a computer can't do. No one gets wet from a computer simulation of a hurricane. So you can simulate a hurricane in a computer. In fact, meteorologists do this all the time to try to figure out what the weather patterns are going to be. And so they and the way that they do the weather prediction is they put all the information they can about the weather into the computer, and they have the computer simulate wind and rain and terrains and how weather systems move around, and they use that to guess what's going to happen, you know, next Tuesday, or where this hurricane is going to land, or whatever. But then he says, yeah, but you have to keep in mind, it's just a simulation. Real hurricanes, there's not a real hurricane inside the computer with real people getting wet. Right? It's just a different thing. And so, he said, that I think we can all agree on, but then he goes a step further and says, if you simulate thinking on a computer, it's still a simulation, it's not really thinking. Really? I can believe that there's wet in the real world and there's, you know, fake wet. But how can there be thinking and fake thinking? If thinking is really just thinking, then why can't... it just doesn't work for me. So, but it is true that, you know, simulated hurricanes don't get people wet. Dreyfus at one point said, computers can all do all these really lovely things, but they sure can't translate languages. And... that's not really an in-principle argument. It is true that certainly at the time that he wrote this, all people had dumped a tremendous amount of time and money into translating between one language and another. Mostly, by the way, at this time, you can guess when it was how can you take documents written in Russian and translate them into English? Why did they put a lot of money into that? Because it was the Cold War, and people in the U.S. wanted to know what the Russians were talking about amongst themselves. So they wanted computers that would just sit around all day and take all the spying information, any information they could get, written information in Russian, and turn it into English. And so they spent a lot of money and time, and they ended up with all kinds of really horrible things. There's this classic example, if people heard this one. So you take the phrase, the spirit is willing, but the flesh is weak. Right? You know that saying? Basically, like, I'd really want to, but my body's just not up for it. You translate that to Russian, and then you take that by computer, and then you translate it back into English by computer, and you get... the wine is good, but the meat is rotten. The spirit, right, can mean an alcoholic beverage, and spirit is willing. The flesh could be meat. It could mean a lot of different things, but it could be meat. And so it got translated as that. And so the fact of the matter is, Dreyfus was right in that computers haven't done a great job of translating languages, but maybe we just haven't done it right yet. There's no a priori reason to think that computers couldn't do this. And in fact, if you've ever had Google translate web pages for you, it gets a lot of stuff right, it gets a lot of stuff wrong, but translation is better now than it was in the 60s. But it's still not what you'd call fluent. And then other philosophers say things like, okay, well, but a computer can never be self-reflective or conscious. And again, it's like, what do you mean by that? I mean, do you have to be conscious? Are any of us conscious? When are we conscious? Most of the time? When we're asleep? I don't know. So that's another one of the claims is no, computers can't be, you know, aware of themselves. But again, I don't see any reason. They could be recursive, right? They could refer to themselves in various ways. I don't know why that would be the case. So I'm not sure this whole philosophical argument doesn't really go anywhere to me. But one of the things that is interesting about this as far as, is that going to be a question? Yeah.
What is like the difference between, like, I know it's like, what would be like a technical name for it? You know, the human mind has the ability to take more stuff from here, and like find the connection and put it together. But how come like computers can't do that? Like,
well, there's
make a reasonable connection all the time, or consistency.
I would say that one of the things that we just don't get how to make computers do at this point is apply those kinds of ideas, but in a very broad setting. We can take any particular example of. Oh, well, if you want to connect this to that, we could write a program to do any particular example. What we don't know how to do is make a generally intelligent computer that can do this example and that example and examples that we haven't even thought about yet. So I wouldn't say that computers can't make those kinds of connections, because I think there's lots of examples where they do and they can. One of the things that I worked on, I guess I won't get to tell you much about it, but I did, when I was at Duke, a group of students and I made a program that solves crossword puzzles. And the crossword puzzle program had to make all kinds of crazy connections in order to solve clues. And so it would find these various sorts of patterns. It discovered that the word diamond is related to baseball in various ways. And if you say something like Rose of the Diamond, you're actually talking about Pete Rose, the baseball player, in a crossword puzzle. And so it was able to make various kinds of connections. One of the students who I worked on that project with is the guy who went on to do the Did You Mean in Google. I don't know if I mentioned that before, but that's another example where it's actually taking not just what you typed, but it's connecting that up with things that other people have typed and words that appear on web pages and telling you maybe, you know, what you typed didn't really make any sense, but maybe you meant this. And those kind of connections, it's remarkable that they can do it. One of the reasons that Google's so powerful is they've got so much data and they've got so much compute power to analyze it that it's starting to get pretty remarkable in terms of the connections that it can make. So, so I wouldn't necessarily agree with the premise of the question.
No, but it's just that they found a universal one that could just take anything and
Right. And it may be that that is a fundamentally hard problem. We'll never solve it. And it may be that we just haven't gotten enough data and compute power yet. I don't think we have the answer. All right, but one of the issues that comes up from this sort of philosophical way of looking at things is you want to ask, well, what does it mean to compute something, and what does it mean for one thing to be more powerful computationally than another thing? And so I'm going to kind of describe that line of thinking with some concrete examples. So it turns out that computers, as we know them, were not the first kind of computational system that was invented. In fact, it's the von Neumann architecture that I showed you. This finite state machine with the memory that goes around and around and it executes machine language statements. You know, von Neumann came up with that. Other people have done very similar things to that. That's one way of thinking about computation. But it turns out that mathematicians around the same time had toyed with other sorts of ideas. So Turing had an idea, a similar kind of idea, that had a finite state machine, but instead of a memory, like a big computer memory that had random access to it, it had this was a theoretical computer, he didn't build it, but it had a big tape, a big long like strip of paper. And the little finite state machine could write on the current square of paper that was in front of it, and it could scroll the paper left and right. And so there's various sorts of functions that you can compute when you have a finite state controller and an infinite tape that can scroll back and forth. And so he was talking about computation in that setting. A guy named Post, another logical mathematician, came up with what were called correspondence rules, which were rules for growing a string. It turned out there were things you could compute with that. Another guy, Alonzo Church, had the lambda calculus, which is all in terms of mathematical functions, but you could specify functions that would do the same kinds of things as a computer. Chomsky is a linguist. And he talked about, when he's studying language, he talked about different levels of power that languages can have. And context-sensitive grammars, string rewrite rules, are what he used to describe human language, that really had other kinds of properties that were similar to computation. Programming languages that we talked about. Well, it turns out that once you have a whole bunch of different ideas, you'd like to know, well, which of these are more powerful than others? Or are they kind of the same as each other? So the basic idea is, well, what if we do this? What if we say, we can take a von Neumann architecture and we can use it to execute programming languages like Scratch. Scratch has a certain amount of expressibility, or Python has a certain amount of expressibility. If we could take the essence of what Python is and simulate it by running it on a von Neumann machine in a machine language, then what do we know? Which one is more powerful? Or which one do we know is, which one is at least as powerful as the other? Right, so it could be that one computing formalism is more powerful than another. It could be that they're the same. What can we rule out? If we can take a von Neumann computer and use it to execute or run other kinds of programs, like Python programs, then which is stronger, Python or the von Neumann architecture? Right? If the von Neumann can do what it can do, plus it can do whatever Python can do, then it can't be any weaker than Python. Right? It has to be that it's either stronger than Python or they're the same. It turns out that you can write in Python a program that simulates a von Neumann architecture. Right? So Python can do everything Python can do, plus it can do anything that a von Neumann architecture can do. So really, these are kind of the same. If one can simulate the other can simulate it back. Neither can do anything that the other one can't. So these, we're going to have to call them equivalent. Well, it turns out that you can also show post-correspondence rules can simulate Turing machines, lambda calculus can simulate a Turing machine, context-sensitive grammars can simulate a Turing machine. So it's looking like Turing machine is getting beat up on, right? Everybody, we're all tougher than you. Well, it turns out a Turing machine can simulate a von Neumann architecture. And you can write programming languages to execute all these other models. So really, which is the strongest? Well, Turing machines seem kind of weak because all the other guys could simulate them, but they can simulate von Neumann, and von Neumann can simulate Python, and Python can simulate Church's lambda calculus, So anything that you could do in any of these, you can do on a Turing machine. In fact, any of them that you could do on any of these, you could do on all of them. There really, none of them is more powerful than any of the others. So it really starts to feel like, you know what, there really is only one answer. These are all exactly the same in terms of power. So that, if you found that kind of example sort of abstract, let me try to explain it another way. So imagine that we just, you know, we remember back in the day when we used to play Mario. And we really liked to play it. I went through something very similar to this, but I tried to update it, because I didn't have Mario when I was playing the game. We know that if we wanted to play Mario, we had the game. We know that this is a Nintendo game machine, which is a kind of computer, that this can actually simulate the Mario world, right? That's what it means to run the program or run the game on this box. It means that this box is doing everything that the box can do, plus it's simulating the Mario world. So we know, we can think of that this way as well, that the Nintendo machine can simulate the Mario world. So now I don't need the Mario world, I don't need to live in the Mario world, I just need a Nintendo game machine, and then that's enough. But I don't have a Nintendo game machine. However, it turns out that there's a thing called Nestopia, which is an emulator for the Nintendo game machine that runs on a PC, like a laptop. So I can run on a laptop, like a PC laptop, Dell, I can run a program that makes the laptop pretend to be a Nintendo game machine. And in fact, the laptop can do everything the laptop can do, plus now it can do anything that the Nintendo game machine can do, which includes running Mario World. So now, if I have Nestopia, and I have the game, and I have a laptop, I can play my game. Well, it turns out that I don't have that kind of laptop, I have a Mac. Okay, we're going to go one more step. It turns out there's a thing called iEmulator, which runs on the Mac and makes the Mac simulate a PC. So now what I could do, I'm not saying this is a good idea, but I can now run on the Mac a program that lets the Mac do everything the Mac can do plus what the PC can do, which if I run Nestopia on that virtual PC, can do everything that the PC can do plus whatever the Nintendo machine can do, which if I run this game on it includes being Mario World. Okay? So this idea of simulate. So now, based on this picture, what's the most powerful of these computers, these worlds, these computing devices? So in this case, the Mac wins, right? The Mac can be everything the Mac is plus that, which can be everything it is plus that, which can be everything that is plus that. So it looks like the Mac is the most powerful. Do I have another comment? So it turns out you can go the other way too. I don't want to say, oh, you know, this is a big advertisement for Mac. Everything that the Mac can do, the PC can also emulate. There are ways of doing that. So these really aren't any more powerful than the other. Though I don't know that the Nintendo machine can act like a Mac. I really do think this is weaker as far as what it can run. So that was really just, other than getting to talk about Mario for a minute, the point of that was to show that this notion of one machine, one type of device simulating another, and therefore being more powerful than another, is exactly what the Church Turing thesis is all about. It's usually taken to mean that any machine computation can be carried out on a Turing machine, that a Turing machine captures all the different kinds of computation, and sometimes expanded to mean that any physical system can be simulated on a Turing machine. So basically, every way that anyone's ever come up with to do computation, they can all be eventually simulated on a Turing machine. And they can all be simulated on each other. There seems to be one kind of computation. But we don't know that for sure. It could be that, you know, next Tuesday somebody says, hey, if you take quantum mechanics and string theory, if you put them together in the right way, there's a whole new kind of computation. But this hasn't happened yet. All the different ideas that people have come up with, they all can be converted back into Turing machines and vice versa. Now, if you really believe this, if you think there really is only one kind of computation, then since our brains live in the physical world and they seem to do computing machine things, it must be that minds are equivalent to Turing machines. Now, this is a leap, and this is not a proven statement, but it's the sort of reasoning that people have done in trying to understand the relationship between computers and minds. All right, so I think what I'm going to do is say a little bit more about this. I'm going to not get too deep into it this time, but the next piece to talk about is, well, what does having a coin do? Like a coin that you can flip. What does that do to computation? Are there things you can do when you have a coin that you can't do without a coin? And it turns out that no one's actually really sure of this. But as far as we know, there are some things that having a coin makes easier. It just doesn't make it any... it doesn't make things possible or impossible. But it can take some things that were hard and make them a lot easier. Which is interesting, because why would it... How would being able to flip a coin really give you any additional power? So let me see if I can... Yeah, so it's awkward. So I know you guys are going to start to bug out and be shorter, because that seems to be what always happens. It doesn't leave me enough time to get into this. But on the other hand, we still have a couple minutes. So I wonder if I can demonstrate any of this stuff in Scratch that would be useful. This is for later. So I do want to... Maybe we can play with loops for a minute. So... Yeah, so let's just take a minute or two and practice our loops. So I'll get back to random numbers in a bit, like next time. But what I've got right here is, what does this little script up there do? Set I to 10, repeat I, play sound pop and wait, change I by negative 1. What would that do?
Pop
10
times.
Keep going. Could just keep going. Oh, yes, interesting. Because I keeps changing and the I is in the loop. So it turns out that in this repeat statement, the I refers to the I when the loop starts. So even if I gets changed, it's whatever it was when this started. So this I is set to 10, it's going to repeat 10 times these steps. It's going to pop, and it's going to change I by minus 1. So we'll hear 10 pop, but what else is going to happen? Watch I over here in the screen. Yeah? See what happened? So it set it to 10, and then each time it popped, I got one smaller, and eventually it made its way down to 0. Right? It just kind of counted down. 10, 9, 8, 7, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, 0. That clear? So what if I took this statement out? So repeat loop, whatever number you tell it, it's going to go that number of times. So it's not paying attention to whether I is changing values or not. So this change I by minus 1 is really not doing anything as far as popping is concerned. What if we change it to 5? What if we change it to 1? What if we change it to 0? We got exactly 0 pops. What if we change it to minus 1? Did you hear that pop get sucked back into the computer?
No.
So it basically, if I is negative, it doesn't do anything. So that would be weird, hearing a negative pop. So, alright, so that's one way of making 10 pops. What about this guy? Set I to 10, repeat until I equals 0, make a pop, make I 1 small. So I didn't realize this before, but you guys are pointing this out to me, that repeat loops, it figures out this number once and then just stays with it. But in a repeat until loop, it actually retests this each time. And when they designed this language, they didn't make that difference very clear, but that's true. That this one, it will repeat it however many times you tell it, and then stop. This one is going to keep repeatedly checking this value. And since I is changing, it's going to get a different value each time. So this one, if you watch the I up in the corner, watch this I up here. It starts off at 10, counts down, and when it hits 0, it says repeat until I is 0, and so it's going to stop at that point. So it's counting down by ones. When it hits 0, it stops. So these are doing much the same thing, but in this case, it actually has to keep reevaluating this test. In the other case, it doesn't. So here's one more loop. You watch I. It's doing the same thing again. It's counting down 10. But this is a much weirder looking loop. Look what it's doing. sets I to 10, and then it repeats the following forever, sort of. Didn't sound like forever. If I is less than 1, stop script. So the reason it doesn't run forever is because once I hits 0, this if statement fires and says, oh, stop the script, pulls the plug, so it has to end. Otherwise, it pops and decreases I by 1. So that's kind of another weird way of saying the same thing. It's not as obvious what it's doing, but it ends up counting down again from 10. So we're going to look a little bit more at these loops next time, but thanks for sticking with me.